I'm thankful for each of you who are with us this evening. If you consider yourself a visitor, we especially and most heartily welcome you. I want to invite your attention this evening to our study in the book of Daniel. Tonight we are up to Daniel chapter 10, which is really just an introductory chapter to the prophecy that's given in Daniel chapter 11. And it's my intentions this evening to try to just briefly touch on the introduction part in Daniel chapter 10 and then get into the meat of the prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 all the way up through about verse 35. So we won't cover all of Daniel chapter 11, but we'll cover most of it. And I want to remind you of something that we've had at different points in our study of the book of Daniel, of the value of prophecies like this in validating the Bible as the Word of God. This particular prophecy that we're going to read tonight in Daniel chapter 11 is one that Daniel received over 500 years before Christ. And what he foretells here is a series of world events, some in very particular detail. And it's not couched in ambiguous language. Some of it, it's pretty straightforward. Some of it, it takes a little thinking to work your way through. But some of it's very straightforward. And it foretells events, especially events within the Persian and the Greek Empire, in unbelievable detail. So much so, there's no way that you could look at this book and say it's not a book from God. And it's so much the case that a lot of skeptics who want to reject the Bible look at places like Daniel chapter 11 and say, it was written after the fact. It's so historically precise in it what it foretells that it's not a foretelling at all. It was just written after the events already took place. The problem is we have copies of Daniel that predate the prophecy's fulfillment in history. So there has to be some predictive element that's very precise and very exact. And as such, it's got to be a book from God. So let's turn our attention now to Daniel chapter 10, where he talks about the timing of where we're at in Daniel's life. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. And the thing was true, but the time appointed was long, and he understood the thing and had understanding of the vision. Now the third year of Cyrus, that would be 3 years after Judah was released from Babylonian captivity. So we're looking at somewhere along the line of 533 B.C. He says, in those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. Daniel was very sad. He was very concerned over the plight of his people, over the plight of their capital city, over the plight of the temple. As a nation, Judah lay in ruins, the city of Jerusalem lay in ruins, and the temple lay in ruins. And that grieved Daniel. And he knew it was because of God's people's rebellion against God, and so he was grieved about that situation. So an angel comes and visits him. And he says, suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you, and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling. Then he said to me, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. We read in our study of Daniel chapter 9 how earnestly Daniel had prayed and what grief and sincerity he had in his heart as he grieved before God, confessing his sin, confessing the sins of the people of Judah, beseeching God to forgive them. And here, Daniel has a comforter, so to speak, coming, an angel coming and saying, I have been sent to you to help you. Your prayer is heard. He reassures Daniel that he's much beloved. And isn't that a comfort to know that when a faithful child of God humbly comes before God in prayer, genuinely contrite about our sin and seeking God's mercy, that God sees beauty in that, that his heart is touched by such things. Now, if we come without a repentant heart, if we come without contrition, it's a different story. But the Bible assures us that God is near, that broken and contrite heart. And that's the kind of heart that Daniel showed as he was repentant and regretful of the sins that had been committed. And so God says, you're much beloved and I'm here to help you. Don't be afraid. And then the angel goes on and divulges a little bit about the activity in which God's angels had been involved. In verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I'd been left alone there with the king of Persia. Then in verse 20, then he said, do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I've gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come. This gives us a little bit of intriguing insight into what's happening in the spiritual world behind the physical world. In the physical world, you see the rise and fall of kingdoms. You see great armies battling on the battlefield. But in the spiritual world, we're given a view here of a spiritual battle that's going on. It's believed by some that this was Gabriel, the angel that was talking, because that's just the angel that speaks elsewhere to Daniel in the book of Daniel. So some would assume that it's Gabriel. Whatever angel it is, he's someone who's in partnership with Michael the archangel. And they've been battling these other princes, or presumably evil angelic beings. You would think of these as Satan's angels, over what's going to happen with Persia and what's going to happen with Greece. And so the angel is telling Daniel, look, this is all about the things between Greece and Persia, and that's why I was delayed in coming to you. And it just so happens that that's what the prophecy is going to be about. It's going to be about some of the events in the closing years of the Persian Empire, and then a lot of things that would go on within the Greek Empire. And so the angel is giving Daniel insight into the fact that God is in control of these things. And he's got his angels out there fighting to make sure things happen the way God wants them to happen. And that shouldn't surprise us, because the Bible teaches us in a lot of different places that God is in control of the events between the nations. And so it's no thing for God to say, well, here's what's going to happen between these nations in the future, because he's going to see to it that it happens. Of course he can foretell it. And that leads us up to the prophecy which he introduces here in Daniel 10 and verse 14. I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come. Daniel is told here it's going to be a long time before some of these things are fulfilled. And a lot of the things that he talked about from the time that Daniel was prophesying was 100, 200, 300, 400, 500 years into the future. You know, when you think of eternity, 500 years is a short span. I understand that. But let's think of that time in other relative terms. How long has the United States stood as a nation? Roughly 250 years, a little less than that. Daniel's seeing into the future twice as long as we've been a nation. And we think of our history as a long and storied history. And from one perspective it is. But these are things that look centuries into the future. And he says it's going to be a long time before this all takes place. Now we go to Daniel chapter 11 and the commencement of the prophecy. Says, also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Let's think of our approach to this prophecy as sort of like putting together a puzzle. I don't know, you may not like to work puzzles, but I used to like to work puzzles. I don't do it much anymore. But one thing I've learned in working puzzles is if you get the edge pieces in place, it makes the rest of it a lot easier. As long as you get the edge pieces where they go, that gets you started, and that helps you kind of sort the other pieces in the right piles where they go to kind of get them in the right place in the puzzle. And if you just sail through Daniel chapter 11, reading through it, thinking, okay, I'm going to understand this prophecy, and you fly through there like a hot knife through butter, you're going to stop and say, well, I can't understand all that unless we come in and get some key pieces in place. And if you come and get some key pieces in place, the rest will fall in line. So Daniel's starting out in the time of Darius the Mede. The Medes were in partnership with the Persians in overthrowing the Babylonians. Cyrus was the Persian king. Darius was the Median king. So Darius is kind of co-regent in a way with Cyrus the Persian. He's just leading over a certain part of the greater empire that was under the rule of Cyrus. Those guys shared in that authority. And so that tells us this is coming early in the time of the Persians. And he says there's going to be three more Persian kings, and then there's going to be a fourth one that's going to be richer than them all, and he's going to stir up a big army against the Greeks. Well, that's that piece of the puzzle that's got part of the barn on it. You know, if there's a barn in your puzzle, and it's got a big part of the barn on that piece, and you say, okay, that's a key piece. I know it goes right here in the middle because I got the picture on the box. And here's what I mean by that. When you start from the beginning of the Persian Empire under Cyrus and Darius and start counting forward, it's not hard to find a king that was rich beyond everybody's wildest dreams that tried to get up this big army to go overthrow Greece. So let's talk about those three kings. Three more kings will arise in Persia. The fourth shall be richer than them all, and he shall stir up all against Greece. The next three Persian kings after Darius was Cambyses, Smerdes, and Darius Hystaspas. They had a lot of the dynasty names there, so you'll see that name Darius repeated several times and other names as well. The fourth king was Xerxes, who was also known as Ahasuerus. If you are recently have studied the book of Esther, you might remember King Ahasuerus. There he blows right there. That's him. He was deliriously wealthy. There's a different historical records that speak of him as the wealthiest king of that day as far as what people knew. Xerxes did the very thing that's described in this prophecy. He gathered forces from 46 nations to stage an invasion of Greece. Now you need to understand that Greece was a wobbly kingdom at this point in time. It was not very strong. And Persia was amassing forces from 46 different nations. World War II was not the Second World War, okay? It is by the, you know, our modern thinking and the way we reckon historical events. But there were tons of nations at war throughout human history at a lot of different intervals and a lot of different times. And here you've got nations from around different parts of the known world joining in with the Persians, and Xerxes using his deep pockets to make it all happen. Various sources calculate his force totaled near 5 million soldiers. That's counting soldiers as well as support personnel. I'm going to tell you, an army of 5 million is large by modern standards. And in these ancient times, there wasn't 6 billion people on the earth, okay? So an army that big was really, really big at that time. And I don't think of that as 5 million guys all carrying swords ready to fight. That's 5 million, counting those guys and also counting the poor fellows that's bringing up the wagon trains of supplies and everybody else that was involved in that activity. But he'll still, that being the case, very, very large force coming to attack Greece. So let's put this on a timeline. We've got King Cyrus ruling at the same time as Darius the Mede, then Smerdes, Cambyses, and Darius. And then here comes that fourth king, King Xerxes, who's getting up this big force to go attack Greece. He's going to punch into southern Europe and expand the Persian Empire deep up into the belly of Europe. That's his plan. All right. Then in verse 3 it says, a mighty king shall stand up and shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Persia's invasion of Greece under Xerxes eventually failed. Recent movies have been made about key battles in that. Now, I haven't watched those movies and I don't recommend them. They may not be historically factual. I'm just telling you that this is a part of human history that's drawn a great deal of interest because such a small handful of Greek soldiers and Greek allies had at different stages stayed off hordes. I mean hordes of Persia's best soldiers. When you look at it militarily, it makes no sense that Persia could not overthrow puny little Greece until you go back to that angel saying, we're up there making sure this thing happens just the way God wants it to happen. And then Persia can't get enough archers to blacken the skies with their arrows. They can't get enough of their so-called immortal soldiers. That's their most elite heavy infantry. Very skilled fighting me, because you can't beat God and his angels, okay? So they could get all the wealth and all the forces and all the nations they wanted, and they're not going to succeed. This helped pave the way for the rise of the Greek Empire and ultimately the fall of the Persian Empire. The generation after the Persian invasion fell, a mighty king among the Greeks rose up, and this is Alexander the Great. Now, when you get that key puzzle in piece in place, and that gets your starting point, okay, we're talking about Xerxes, also known as Ahasuerus. From there, the rest of it falls in line. The mighty king who comes up, well, the only other king after him that was mighty wasn't one of the Persians. They had kings, but they weren't strong. Alexander the Great was. So he would stand up and he would rule with great dominion, and he defeated the Persians within about 12 years, in a 12-year window of time, with a much, much smaller force. He went in and from stem to stern whipped the Persian army from one end of Persia to the other and overthrew every major Persian city. So putting it back on the timeline, the vision skips from Xerxes overlooking five kings leading up to that next generation when Alexander the Great would arise, and in a 12-year period he would conquer the Persian Empire. Now this map gives you a view of the Greek Empire. Once they had overthrown the Persians, they had a chunk of southern Europe. When you look in the history books, some of them will show the lower Peloponnese as part of the Greek Empire, some of them won't. They had varying degrees of control over those territories, but their territory stretched all the way down into Egypt and all the way over here to even to northern India. The Greek invasion expanded. Now, Daniel 11 and 4 says, "When he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided towards the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those." Once we got started, it's like dominoes. Everything just keeps falling and leads to the next, which leads to the next. We got our good start with Xerxes there, and it's led us up to Alexander. And this makes sense when you know the history of Alexander's rule. He died at the age of 33, right after conquering the Persians. He perished. It says in history that he had no son who was a proper heir to the throne. And what happened? What did the prophecy say? He said his kingdom would be divided, but not to his posterity. It's not going to be one of his offspring that would be an heir to the throne. It took about 21 years for the fighting to be over and the smoke to clear to figure out who was going to be in control after Alexander's death. The generals was quibbling and squabbling, and he had tried to set it up, and you know it's going to shock you, but these guys all wanted more power than what was apportioned to them, and so they argued and carried on, and then eventually, when it was all settled, the Greek Empire was divided four ways: Macedon, Thrace, Syria, and Egypt. And much of the rest of Daniel chapter 11, in fact, the remainder of Daniel 11, deals with wars between the Syrians and the Egyptians. The Syrians being referred to as the Seleucids, and the Egyptians being referred to as the Ptolemies, after the respective dynasties that ruled over their realm. So putting it on the timeline, the kingdom of the Greeks was split four ways, and that leads us up to the first king in the war here that's described from in the balance of Daniel 11. Also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion. All right, king of the south, what's that? It's not Robert E. Lee, right? You know, it's not somebody in South America. You see what I mean? We could get crazy with King of the South. We'd just pick a spot on the map that's south of where we're standing at the moment and come up with something. But we're not going to do that. We're going to remember our key piece in the puzzle that got us started. And okay, this is King of the South. South what? Well, I'm thinking of that four-way division of the Greek Empire. And in that four-way division of the Greek Empire, when you look at it on a map, the southern part of that was Egypt. It was the Ptolemies. And so when he says king of the south, I'm going to look at that and I'm going to say, well, that's the king of the Ptolemies. Now, there are a lot of different beliefs about how you approach some of these Old Testament prophecies. There are beliefs that all these events pertain to things that were fulfilled leading up to the time of Christ and the fall of Rome. That's the view that I take. There are other beliefs that stretch some of these things all the way to the end of time, and that's generally called the premillennial view. And I just want to tell you that the spot we're at right now, all those different families of theories about the book of Daniel agree. This section is about the wars between Syria and Egypt. And the more we look at how detailed it was fulfilled, the more obvious it becomes. It couldn't be anything else. The first king of the south was Ptolemy Soter. The prince referred to here in this passage is Seleucus Nicator, who served as his general for a short time. Ptolemy was stronger than Seleucus and had greater dominion. And Ptolemy controlled Palestine and Phoenicia, that area up there that was the land of Judah that concerned Daniel so much. All right. Then comes a marriage, a political arrangement to try to secure someone's power. In Daniel 11, verse 5. Also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion, and at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north and make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her and with him who begot her and with him who strengthened her in those times. Now think like Daniel, being from the land of Judah. Egypt is south of them. Who's north of them? Syria, the Seleucids. And so thinking of the king of the north and the king of the south, relative to the way Daniel saw things, we're seeing events between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And there was conflict between those two over how Judah should be divided. They attempted to remedy this by Bernice marrying Antiochus II. Now, Antiochus II was the ruler in the north. He was a ruler over Syria. He was at this time the king of the north. And what did the king of the south do? He sent his daughter Bernice up there to marry this other king, this opposing king, thinking that'll bring peace between the two kingdoms, and we can all agree that Judah and Phoenicia ought to be ours and they'll leave us alone about it. That's his thinking. And those kinds of politically arranged marriages are very, very common in human history. So Antiochus II divorced his wife at that time, a woman by the name of Laodice, to make the marriage there with Bernice. Well, Laodice didn't like that. You can imagine why. And this triggered a series of events that historians refer to as the Laodicean Wars, because there was a little bit of hair in the butter over this. Oh, you're going to divorce me to make an alliance with that guy's daughter, huh? Well, we'll see how well that works. So she eventually killed Bernice and her child. Well, back in the South, Grandpa don't like that. See, granddads don't like it when people kill their grandbabies. And they don't like it when people kill their daughters that bore those grandbabies. So those things tend to cause strife between nations. And here these nations are already bickering. So you can see tensions are beginning to mount. So revenge is on the brain. From a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, and with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Also the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but he shall return to his own land. All right, a branch of her roots. Don't let that language bother you a little bit. An offspring of Bernice's roots is going to be her brother. What's her roots? That's her mom and dad. Well, an offspring of mom and dad is your sibling. That makes sense, doesn't it? Okay. Well, in history, Ptolemy III, who was brother to Bernice, he's the next ruler of the Ptolemies, and so he comes and attacks for revenge because Laodicea killed somebody's grandbaby, okay? And Laodicea killed somebody's daughter, and so somebody's going to spill blood for this crime. So he came to power and attacked Syria, then led by Seleucus Callinicus. And his attack brought great success, allowing him to plunder Syria, take a lot of wealth back home, just like the prophecy describes. So Ptolemy III then enjoyed peace in his kingdom and had no trouble with the Seleucids. The Seleucids, for a time, were beat down and defeated from all these events. So we've got a period of Ptolemaic dominance in history, and that period is foretold in Daniel 11, verse 5 through 11. And when you look at those events as they're foretold in the prophecy, and then look at what really happened in history, it just lines up point for point. So what happens now? Well, let's look at the king of the south here on that map, the southern part there. You'll notice there, they had a little bit of territory up here in the tip of Asia Minor. They kept trying to expand their hold on power. And there were times they might have expanded a little bigger than what you see on the map here. But that's a general representation of their foothold on power. All right, then the Seleucids enjoyed a period of success. Verse 10, however, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife, and the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him. But the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but that multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. And when he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. So Seleucus III and Seleucus IV, of the Syrian kingdom, successfully made war. Him and his sons, you see, stirring up strife. That's these two guys. And Antiochus III, who was the next Seleucid king, attacked Egypt and enjoyed some success. That's the king of the north there, having a great multitude coming out against the king of the south. But notice what happened next. The king of the south was moved with rage, and the multitude was given into the enemy's hand, and so tens of thousands were killed, but the king of the south ultimately didn't prevail. So Ptolemy IV assembled a great force to fight against Antiochus III. He was also called Antiochus Theos, or Antiochus the God, because a lot of those kings presented themselves as gods. And Ptolemy won a critical battle at a place called Raphia. If you're a history buff, go look that up on the map. That was a very important battle that was fought there. And the Syrians lost, and so the Egyptian king there killed thousands of Syrian soldiers. His heart was lifted up, and he cast down tens of thousands, just like Daniel said would happen. But the king of the south, though he enjoyed success, that his success was short-lived. A larger force comes into play. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one will stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. So let's break this down. Antiochus III returned home and built a force larger than his first, and many joined with Antiochus, including some Jews, just as the prophecy foretold. And this wound up being their undoing, the Jews' undoing, because till now the Ptolemies had treated them fairly well under Ptolemaic rule. But when the Seleucids began to control them, they mistreated them very severely. Antiochus III took key cities such as Sidon and took key cities in Judah. And then he tried to strengthen his homeland and placate the Jews to reinforce his hold on power. And again, we have a political marriage. He gave his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy V, hoping she would subvert Egypt and give him control. He's thinking, my daughter will go down there and marry this guy, and then I'll have her there in the palace, and she'll make him do what I want him to do. But she was not faithful to her father. She wound up being loyal to her new husband. So that didn't work either. That political marriage didn't work. So after this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands. He shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land. But he shall stumble and fall and not be found. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. This is very specific information that you can find point for point in the history between these empires. Look at what happened. After the marriage of his daughter to Ptolemy V failed, Antiochus turned his attention to the coastlands of Asia Minor and Thrace. He went up there and tried to take southern Europe. He wanted more of the Greek Empire. A prince, in this case a Roman general, defeated him. He was quite humiliated in defeat. This was Cornelius Scipio, who defeated Antiochus III at Magnesia, charged him a great tax, and took his son, Antiochus Epiphanes, captive to Rome to hold him as a ransom for the full payment of that tax. And in the ancient times, that's a lot of times what happened. When you lost a war, your enemy would say, all right, you're going to give us so much money, and then they would take certain key characters home captive and hold them until they got all the money they were supposed to get. So the guy gets humiliated up there in southern Europe. He can't conquer the territories that he wants to conquer. He runs into a little problem called a rising Roman Empire, and they whipped him. So he suffered defeat at Thermopylae as well, and at the hands of Achilles Glabrio, I'm sure I said that just wrong, Antiochus returned home in disgrace, where he remained until his death. Seleucus Philopater then came to power after this, and he was notorious for raising taxes. Politicians never change, especially seeking to collect special fees from the Jews. Remember, it said he would tax the glorious land. His reign was short. He died, though not in battle nor as an act of anger. He was killed by an aide as a political expediency. Okay, so that shows us the rise of Seleucid power going up to verse 20. All right, let's pick it up there and look at the map of kind of the greatest expanse of the Seleucid Empire. They had part of southern Europe for a while. They had extended their fingers down here into Egypt, but never could permanently hold that territory. But their power stretched all the way back over towards Babylon. Now, verse 21, and in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. The next king was the notorious Antiochus Epiphanes. Remember, he's the guy that the Romans captured and took home and held for ransom till daddy paid all the fees for losing the war. He was an extraordinarily vile person. The Jews called him, as a play on words, Antiochus Epimenes, which meant Antiochus the madman. They despised him, and understandably so. His nephew, Demetrius, was true heir to the crown, but Antiochus usurped the throne while Demetrius was at Rome. You see, they wouldn't give him the honor of royalty. They didn't make him the king, so he just came in peacefully when the king was out of town, and he took the kingdom over by trickery. That's exactly what the prophecy said would happen, and that's exactly what took place. Verse 22, with the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. This is a general review of the exploits of Antiochus Epiphanes. He excelled his forebears, even his dad, in the degree of success that he had had against the Egyptians and against others. He overthrew the prince of the covenant, which in this case is going to refer to the high priest there of the Jewish faith. And this was fulfilled when Onias III was killed during the reign of Antiochus. He promised larger tribute to Antiochus. Jason, the brother of Onias, did this, and he succeeded in having himself appointed as high priest. So the brother of the high priest subverted the high priest and got in league with Antiochus, which continued the Jews' downfall sort of under the Seleucid boot. Picking it up now at verse 23, after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, For he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province. And he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So this adds to what we had learned earlier. His exploits would exceed what his dad and his ancestors had done. He would have more success, but it would be a short-lived success. After making a truce with the Ptolemies, Antiochus became stronger by trickery. Though the Syrian people were small in number, he reached great power with them, with a small number of people. When Ptolemy Philometor ascended to the throne, Antiochus sent Apollonius to Egypt, supposedly to congratulate the new king. In reality, he was to spy out the strength of the new ruler. Antiochus is planning an invasion of Egypt. He wants to overthrow Egypt, and he's about to get it done. It says in verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Antiochus gathered forces against Egypt for a major invasion, fighting against the king of the south. The first invasion was a great success for Antiochus, and many in the Egyptian army were killed. In verse 27 and 28, both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he shall do damage in return to his own land. So, Antiochus Epiphanes had taken possession of the Egyptian rival, Ptolemy Philometor. He had captured the rival king and kidnapped him to take him home. And in the wake of this, the Egyptians made Ptolemy Physcon their king. And this stage set the stage for Antiochus to use more of his political trickery. He persuaded his captive king there to aid him in an invasion of Egypt under the pretext of helping him retake the throne from Ptolemy Physcon. Now, who's going to believe all this? Oh, I just overthrew your kingdom. Why don't you help me go attack them again so I can put you back in power? Of course he's lying. But so is his rival. They're both at the same table lying to each other, and history tells us about their negotiations, and they're each trying to out Whataburger the other one and get the upper hand and gain the advantage in getting themselves greater power. But this did not wind up subduing all of Egypt. Verse 28 says, while returning to his land with his riches, his heart will be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he would do great damage, return to his land. Antiochus said, you know what? I'm going to fight against the Jews and the God of the Jews. So after this series of battles, he returned to his homeland by way of Judah. And he had used force to depose Jason from the position of high priest, and in the place appointed a man who was a Benjamite as a priest. Of course, that was against Moses' law. That was a total violation of the law for a Benjamite to serve as the priest. And while he was in Egypt, Jason attempted to reclaim his position as high priest. And having heard of this, Antiochus Epiphanes thought he would go back through Judah and punish the Jews. So on his return from Egypt, Antiochus slaughtered many Jews and took many into slavery. Menelaus made the temple treasure available to Antiochus, trying to butter up the king so he'd have more secure power. And so Antiochus walked into the temple, which is a violation of the law, and robbed it of its treasures. This begins his systematic defilement of the temple of God there in Jerusalem. You got to know this is not what Daniel wanted to hear, because he's sitting there grieving over the temple being in ruins, and he's hearing it's going to happen again. So there's another invasion. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. The former and the latter likely refers to the two previous invasions. That's one by his dad, Antiochus III, and then the first one that he had executed against the Egyptians. The former would be the last campaign, as I just said, Antiochus the Great brought, and then that was successful to a degree, and then the other one that was somewhat successful was the first one that Antiochus Epiphanes brought about against the Egyptians. So the Seleucids are having success, but this next invasion is going to be different. Both of these campaigns produced a reasonable degree of success. The next one ended in his total humiliation. I really want to see a movie made about this sometime if they'll make it clean and historically accurate. Ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Here's what happened. Antiochus had gotten as far as Alexandria and was just about to bring Egypt under his control. He had just about completely defeated them. But Ptolemy Physcon had appealed to the Romans for help. And Cyprus at this time was a Roman dominion and where they kept a lot of their navy. If you'll look at it on a map, Cyprus is an island that's sort of between Italy and Egypt. So he'd sent word to Rome saying, come help us. And this series of events is what made Egypt become part of the Roman Empire. So the Romans sent representative to warn Antiochus Epiphanes. And let me tell you what the representative did. These guys were cool. They go down there and they confront Antiochus. Get out of Egypt. It's now part of Rome. Antiochus, being the politician, said, well, let me think about it. And the Roman general took a stick and drew a circle in the dirt around Antiochus and said, you better make up your mind before you step out of that circle or you're at war with Rome. He stuck his tail between his legs and went to the house. After this humiliation, Antiochus returned and he took his frustrations out on the Jews, just like a bully will do. When he can't win one battle, he's going to go fight another one that he knows that he can win. Or he thinks he can win it. So on the Sabbath, he attacked Orthodox Jews, taking many captives. You know, he showed regard for those Jews who would forsake the covenant. There was a culture war going on in Judah at this time. And under the rulership of Antiochus Epiphanes, he was trying to force the Jews to give up their Hebrew ways and just live like Greeks. We think there's a culture war going on now, and there is. The thing is, there's always been a culture war going on where Satan is trying to erode away at the faithfulness of God's people. And that was what was happening here. In verse 31 through 33, forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captive and plundering. Soon after the assault on the Jews, Antiochus stopped the daily temple sacrifice and set up a statue of Jupiter in the temple. They sacrificed a pig on the altar and compared Jews to participate in pagan rituals to honor Bacchus, a pagan deity. He was getting about as far out against the law of Moses as he could. Jews were forbidden to practice circumcision and they were forbidden to call themselves Jews. He's trying to totally assimilate them into Greek culture. In verse 34 and 35, now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Antiochus's ill treatment of Orthodox Jews continued for some time. However, faithful Jews persisted in serving God and following God's law, and they had some help and some moments of relief, but many died, just as the prophecy describes. So here on the map, you see the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes that's described from verse 21 through 45. We got up through verse 34 or 35, I think. Now, you really want to see this guy get his comeuppance because he's been just about as wicked as a person could be. And the things that he's done against God's people have been terrible. And you're just going to have to stay tuned till the next lesson. We're going to find out what happened to him and how he got his. But let's review what we've covered so far in our studies in the book of Daniel. In Daniel 2, we talked about that vision of the four world empires and God's kingdom being established in the days of the Roman Empire. In Daniel chapter 4, we talked about that period there in Nebuchadnezzar's reign when he was more or less put out to pasture and lived like a wild man, but then was restored in order to humble him and show him that God is in control. In Daniel 5, we read about the handwriting on the wall that foretold the end of the Babylonian Empire. In Daniel 7, we had four beasts that corresponded with the four sections of Nebuchadnezzar's dream from Daniel chapter 2. They lined up with these same four world empires that we've been talking about that were very relevant to the issues there with God's people. In Daniel 8, we read about a ram and a one-horned goat, and that one horn was Alexander the Great. And when he died, four horns come up in his place, just like what we talked about tonight, where Greece was divided four ways. Then we talked about the prophecy of the 2300 days being a period of time that we brushed into tonight, beginning when Antiochus robbed the temple and ending when he, as a temple robber, was put to death vindicating or cleansing the temple. In Daniel 9, we looked at the prophecy of the 77s that spanned the restoration and the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem and dealt with the coming of the Messiah and the redestruction of the city of Jerusalem and its temple at the hands of the Romans. Now in Daniel chapter 11, we've read about the Persian kings. We've read about Alexander the Great. We've read about the four-way division and some of the wars between Syria and Egypt. And that's where we'll pick up our study there, Lord willing, the next time we study. And we'll also look in Daniel 12, where he says something about 1290 days and 1335 days. And that will be the subject of our next lesson on the book of Daniel. I hope you look forward to that. I hope as we've studied these things tonight, it's been impressed upon your mind how utterly precise Daniel's prophecy is. And there's no way he could have known these things in advance unless God revealed it through the angel, just as we've been shown here in the scriptures. It's things like this, along with many other evidences, that are the reasons that I believe the Bible is a book from God. And I hope you share that faith. And because we have that faith, we believe the Bible's warnings. Warnings we heard about in this morning's lessons about the end of time, the need for us to be prepared to meet our God. And if you're not prepared to meet your God, we want to help you. We want to help you in either in obedience to the gospel, or if you're a Christian, you need the prayers of the church, we want to help you with that. If we can help you in either way, please come. Have a seat on the front pew while we stand and while we sing.